Sleeping? Is the first thing Katie says.
Sort of.
I can't believe that was Bill Stein.
Neither can we. What's going on?
I'm at the newsroom. Can you come over?
Now?
You're busy?
There's something I don't like in her voice, a touch of distance I'm awake just enough to notice. Let me jump in the shower. I'll be there in 15 minutes.
I'm already undressing when she hangs up the phone.
While I get ready, I've got two things on my mind. Stein and Katie. They toggle in my thoughts like someone flicking a switch to check a bulb. In the light, I see her, but in the dark, I see Dickinson Courtyard, canvassed in snow, in the silence after the ambulance has left.
Back at our quad, I throw my clothes on in the common room, trying not to rouse Paul. Searching for my watch, I notice something. The room's even cleaner than when I went to bed. Someone has straightened the rugs and emptied the trash cans. A bad sign. Charlie didn't sleep last night. Then I catch sight of a message written on the whiteboard.
Tom, couldn't sleep. Gone to Ivy for more work. Call when you're up. P.
Back in the bedroom, Paul's bunk is empty. Looking at the whiteboard again, I spot the numbers above the text. 2:15. He's been gone all night. I raise the receiver again, about to dial the president's room, when I hear the voicemail tone.
Friday, the automated voice says when I punch in the digits. 11:54 p.m.
What follows is the call I missed, the one that must have come while Paul and I were at the museum.
Tom? It's Katie.
A pause.
I'm not sure where you are. Maybe you're already on your way over. Karen and Trish want to serve birthday cake now. I told them to wait for you.
Another pause.
I guess I'll see you when you get here.
The phone is hot in my hand. The black and white photo I bought for her birthday looks dull in its frame, a cheaper thing than it was yesterday. To name a photographer other than Ansel Adams and Matthew Brady, I'd had to ask around. I never learned enough about Katie's pastime to feel confident about her taste. Thinking it over, I decide not to bring the photo with me. On the walk to the Prince's office, I keep a brisk pace. Katie meets me at the entrance and leads me toward the dark room, locking and unlocking doors as we go. She's dressed the same way she was at Holder, in a t-shirt and an old pair of jeans. Her hair is pulled back crookedly, as if she wasn't expecting company, and the neck of her shirt is bent out of shape. I can see a gold necklace crossing her collarbone on one side, and near the thigh of her jeans my eyes linger on a tiny hole where the white of her skin peeks through.
Tom, she says, pointing to someone at a computer in the corner, there's someone I want you to meet. This is Sam Felton.
Sam smiles as if she knows me. She's dressed in field hockey issue sweatpants and a long-sleeve shirt that says, if journalism were easy, Newsweek would do it. After reaching for a button on the microcorder beside her, she pulls the bud of an earphone out of one ear.
Your date tonight?
She says to Katie, just to make sure she heard right. Katie says yes, but doesn't add what I expect. My boyfriend.
Sam's working on the Bill Stein story, she says instead. Have fun at the ball, Sam tells me, before reaching for the recorder again. You're not coming? Katie asks.
I gather they also know each other from Ivy.
I doubt it.
Sam motions back at the computer, where rows of words scramble across the screen, an ant farm behind the glass. She already reminds me of Charlie and his lab, inspired by how much remains to be done. There will always be more news to write, more theories to prove, more phenomena to observe. The delicious futility of impossible tasks is the catnip of overachievers. Katie gives a sympathetic look, and Sam returns to transcribing.
What did you want to talk about? I ask.
But Katie leads me back to the darkroom.
It's a little hot in here, she says, opening a door and forcing back a thick set of black curtains. You might want to take off your coat. I do, and she hangs it from a hidden hook by the door. I've avoided the inside of this room since I met her, terrified of ruining her film. Katie walks over to a clothesline strung along one wall. Photographs are clipped to it with clothespins. It's not supposed to get above 75 in here, she says, or the soup reticulates the negatives. She might as well be speaking Greek. There's an old rule my sisters taught me. Whenever you go on a date with a girl, always meet at a place you know well. French restaurants aren't impressive when you can't read the menu, and highbrow movies backfire when you don't understand the plot. Here in the darkroom, the possibilities for failure seem spectacular. Give me a second, she says, shuttling from one side of the room to the other, quick as a hummingbird. I'm almost done. She opens the cover to a small tank, brings the film inside it to a spigot, then places it under running water. I start to feel crowded. The darkroom is small and cluttered, counters overrun with pans and trays, shelves lined with stop bath and fixer. Katie seems to have almost perfect dexterity here. It reminds me of the way she did her hair at the reception, tying it around pins as if she could see what she was doing. Should I turn out the lights? I ask, starting to feel useless. Not unless you want to. The negatives are fixed. So I stand like a scarecrow in the center of the room. How's Paul holding up? She asks. Okay. A respectful silence ensues, and Katie seems to lose the thread of the conversation, attending to another set of photos. I stopped by Dodd just after 12:30, she begins again. Charlie said you were with Paul. There's an unexpected sympathy in her voice. It was good of you to stay with him, she says. This must be terrible for Paul, for everyone. I want to tell her about Stein's letters, but realize how much explaining it would take. She returns to my side now with a handful of pictures. What are these? I developed our film. From the movie field? She nods. The movie field is a place Katie brought me to see, an open plot in Princeton Battlefield Park that seems to extend farther and flatter than any stretch of land east of Kansas. A single oak tree stands in the middle of it, like a sentinel who won't leave his post, echoing the last gesture of a general who died beneath the tree's branches during the Revolutionary War. Katie first saw the spot in a Walter Matthau movie, and ever since then, the tree has been an enchantment for her. It became one in a small string of places she visited over and over again, a rosary of sights that anchored her life the more she returned to them. Within a week of her first night at Dodd, she took me to see it. And it was as if the old Mercer Oak were a relative of hers, all three of us making an important first impression. I brought a blanket, a flashlight, and a picnic basket. Katie brought film and a camera. The pictures are an artifact I don't expect, a small part of us locked in amber. We work through them together, sharing between our hands. What do you think? She says. Seeing them, I remember how warm the winter was. January's fading light is almost the color of honey, and here we are, both dressed in light sweaters, with coats and hats and gloves nowhere to be seen. The grooves of the tree behind us have the texture of age. They're wonderful, I tell her. Katie smiles awkwardly, still unsure how to take a compliment. I notice stains on her fingertips, the color of newsprint, left by one of the darkroom agents bottled along the wall. Her fingers are long and thin, but with a workmanlike touch, the residue of too much film dipped in too many chemical baths. This was us, she's saying, 1,000 words at a time. Remember? I'm sorry, I tell her. My grip on the pictures loosens, but she reaches for my fingers with her other hand. It's not because of my birthday, she says, worried I've missed the point. I wait. Where did you and Paul go after you left Holder last night? To see Bill Stein. She pauses over the name but presses on. About Paul's thesis? It was urgent. What about when I stopped by your room just after midnight?
The art museum.
Why?
I'm uncomfortable with the direction she's taking.
I'm sorry I didn't come over. Paul thought he could find Kelowna's crypt and he needed to look at some of the older maps.
Katie doesn't seem surprised. A hush gathers behind her next words, and I know this is the conclusion she's been building toward.
I thought you were done with Paul's thesis, she says.
So did I.
You can't expect me to watch you do this all over again, Tom. Last time we didn't talk for weeks.
She hesitates, not knowing how else to put it.
I deserve better.
A boy's way is to argue, to find a defensible position and hold it, even if it's not heartfelt. I can feel the arguments crowding into my mouth, the little spurs of self-preservation, but Katie stops me.
Don't, she says. I want you to think about this.
She doesn't have to spell it out. Our hands part. She leaves the pictures in mine. The hum of the darkroom returns. Like a dog I've kicked, the silence always seems to take her side.
The choice is made, I want to tell her. I don't need to think this through. It's simple. I love you more than I love the book.
But to say it now would be the wrong choice. Part of this isn't about answering the question correctly. It's about showing that I'm correctable, that twice broken, I can still be fixed. 12 hours ago, I missed her birthday because of the hypnerotomachia. My promises would seem empty right now, even to me. Okay, I say. Katie brings a hand to her mouth and bites at a nail, then catches herself and stops.
I should work, she says, touching my fingers again. Let's talk more about this tonight.
I stare at the nub of her nail, wishing I could inspire more confidence. She pushes me toward the black curtains, handing me my coat, and we return to the main office.
I need to finish the rest of my roles before the senior photographers take over the darkroom, she says on the way, more for Sam's benefit than for mine. You're a distraction.
The artifice is wasted. Sam's earphones are still in place, focused on her typing. She doesn't notice me leaving. At the door, Katie takes her hands away from the small of my back. She seems prepared to speak, but doesn't. Instead, she leans over and gives me a kiss on the cheek, the kind I used to get in our earliest days as a reward for jogs in the morning. Then she holds the door for me as I leave. Chapter 18. Love conquers all. In seventh grade, at a small souvenir stand in New York, I bought a silver bracelet with that inscription for a girl named Jenny Harlow. I thought it was, in one stroke, a portrait of the young man she wanted to date. Cosmopolitan, with its Manhattan pedigree. Romantic, with its poetic-sounding motto. And classy, with its understated shine. I left the bracelet anonymously in Jenny's locker on Valentine's Day, then waited all day for a response, thinking she was sure to know who'd left it. Cosmopolitan, romantic, and classy, unfortunately, didn't form a trail of breadcrumbs leading directly back to me. An eighth grader named Julius Murphy must have had that combination of virtues in much greater supply than I did, because it was Julius who got a kiss from Jenny Harlow at the end of the day, while I was left with nothing but a dark suspicion that the family vacation to New York had been for naught. The whole experience, like so much of childhood, was built on misunderstanding. It wouldn't occur to me until much later that the bracelet wasn't made in New York any more than it was made of silver. But that very Valentine's night, my father explained the particular misinterpretation he found most telling, which was that the poetic-sounding motto wasn't quite as romantic as Julius, Jenny, and I thought. "You may have gotten the wrong impression from Chaucer," he began with the smile of paternal wisdom. "There's more to Love Conquers All than just the prioress's brooch."
I sensed that this was going to be a lot like the conversation we'd had about babies and storks a few years before, well-intentioned, but based on a serious misunderstanding about what I'd been learning in school. A long explanation followed about Virgil's 10th eclogue and Omnia Wincit Amor, with digressions about Scythonian snows and Ethiopian sheep, all of which mattered a lot less to me than why Jenny Harlow didn't think I was romantic, and why I'd found such a useless way of blowing $12. If love conquered all, I decided, then love had never met Julius Murphy. But my father was a wise man in his way, and when he saw he wasn't getting through to me, he opened a book and showed me a picture that made his point for him. Agostino Carracci made this engraving, called Love Conquers All, he said. What do you see? On the right side of the picture were two naked women. On the left side, a baby boy was beating up a much larger and more muscular satyr. I don't know, I said, unsure which side of the picture I was supposed to be learning from. That, my father said, pointing to the boy, is love. He let it sink in. He's not supposed to be on your side. You fight with him. You try to undo what he does to others. But he's too powerful. No matter how much we suffer, Virgil says, our hardships cannot move him. I'm not sure I ever completely understood the lesson my father was imparting. I got the simplest bit of it, I think. By trying to make Jenny Harlow fall head over heels for me, I was arm-wrestling love, which my own cheap bracelet had been telling me was futile. But I sensed even then that my father was only using Jenny and Julius as an object lesson. What he really wanted to offer was a piece of wisdom he'd come by the hard way, which he hoped to impress upon me while the stakes of my own failures were still small. My mother had warned me about misguided love, my father's affair with the Hypnerotta Machia always in the back of her mind, and now my father was offering his counterpoint, riddled in Virgil and Chaucer. He knew exactly how she felt, he was saying, he may even have agreed. But how could he stop it? What power did he have against the force he was fighting, when love conquered all? I've never known which of the two of them was right. The world is a Jenny Harlow, I think. We're all just fishermen telling stories about the one that got away. But to this day, I'm not sure how Chaucer's Prioress interpreted Virgil, or how Virgil interpreted love. All that stays with me is the picture my father showed me, the part he never said a word about, where the two naked women are watching love bully the satyr. I've always wondered why Carracci put two women in that engraving when he only needed one. Somewhere in that is the moral I took from the story. In the geometry of love, everything is triangular. For every Tom and Jenny, there's a Julius. For every Katie and Tom, there's a Francesco Colonna. And the tongue of desire is forked, kissing two, but loving one. Love draws lines between us like an astronomer plotting a constellation from stars, joining points into patterns that have no basis in nature. The butt of every triangle becomes the heart of another, until the roof of reality is a tessellation of love affairs. Taken together, they have the pattern of netting, and behind them, I think, is love. Love is the only perfect fisherman, the one who casts the broadest net, which no fish can escape. His reward is to sit alone in the tavern of life, forever a boy among men, hoping someday to tell stories about the one that got away. The rumor was that Katie had found someone else. I'd been replaced by a junior named Donald Morgan, a wiry tower of a man who wore a blazer when a simple dress shirt would do, and who was already priming himself to be Gill's successor as Ivy president. I happened on the new couple one night in late February at Small World Coffee, the same place where I'd met Paul 3 years earlier, and a cool exchange followed.
Donald managed to say only two or three chummy, innocuous things before realizing I wasn't a potential voter in the club elections, at which point he ushered Katie out of the shop and into his old Shelby Cobra on the street. It was death by paper cut, watching him turn the engine three times before it finally roared to life. I couldn't tell whether it was for my benefit or his vanity, the way he idled in his space for another minute until the road was completely empty before pulling out. All I noticed was that Katie never looked at me, not even as they drove away. Worse, she seemed to be ignoring me out of anger rather than embarrassment, as if it were my fault, not hers, that we'd come to this. The outrage of it festered until I decided there was nothing else I could do but surrender. Let her have Donald Morgan, I thought. Let her make her bed at Ivy. Of course, Katie was right. It was my fault. I'd been struggling for weeks with the fourth riddle. What do a blind beetle, a night owl, and a twist-beaked eagle share? And I sensed that my luck had run dry. Animals in the intellectual world of the Renaissance were tricky subjects. In the same year Carracci made his engraving, Omnia Wingkit Amor, an Italian professor named Ulisse Aldrovandi published the first of his 14 volumes on natural history. In one of the most famous examples of his approach to classification, Aldrovandi spent only 2 pages identifying the various breeds of chickens, then added another 300 pages on chicken mythology, chicken-related recipes, and even chicken-based cosmetic treatments. Meanwhile, Pliny the Elder, the ancient world's authority on animals, placed unicorns, basilisks, and manticores on the page directly between rhinos and wolves, and offered his own accounts of how chicken eggs could foretell the sex of a pregnant woman's child. Within 10 days of staring at the riddle, I felt like one of the dolphins Pliny described, enchanted by human music but unable to make any of my own. Surely Colonna had something clever in mind with this riddle of his. I was just dumb to its magic. The first thesis deadline I missed came 3 days later, when I realized, half-sunk in a pile of Aldrovandi photocopies, that a draft of my final chapter on Frankenstein lay unfinished on my desk. My advisor, Dr. Montrose, a sly old English professor, saw my bloodshot look and knew I must be up to something. Never suspecting it was anyone other than Mary Shelley who'd kept me up so many nights, he let the deadline slip. The next one slipped, too, and so, very quietly, began the lowest period of my senior year, a stretch of weeks when no one seemed to notice my slow withdrawal from my own life. I slept through morning classes and spent afternoon lectures working riddle solutions in my head. More than one night I watched Paul break from his studies early, hardly past 11, to walk with Charlie to Hoagie Haven for a late-night sandwich. They always asked me to come along, then asked if they could bring me anything back, but I always refused. At first because I took pride in the monastic quality my life had assumed, then later because I saw something derelict in the way they seemed to be ignoring their work. The night Paul went to get ice cream with Gil, instead of doing more research on the hypnerotomachia, I imagined for the first time he wasn't pulling his own weight in our partnership. "You've lost your focus," I told him. My eyes were getting worse because I had to read in the dark, and it couldn't have come at a worse time.
"Of what?"
Paul said, turning around before climbing to his bunk. He thought he'd misheard.
"How many hours are you spending on this a day?"
"I don't know, maybe 8.
"I've put in 10 every day this week, and you're the one going to get ice cream?" "I was gone for 10 minutes, Tom, and I made a lot of progress tonight. What's the problem?"
"It's nearly March. Our deadline is in a month." He let the pronoun pass.
"I'll get an extension. Maybe you should work harder."
It was probably the first time anyone had ever spoken those words in Paul's presence. I'd seen him angry only a handful of times, but never like that.
"I am working hard. Who do you think you're talking to?"
"I'm close to figuring out the riddle. Where are you?"
"Close?"
Paul shook his head.
You're not doing this because you're close. You're doing it because you're lost. The riddle shouldn't be taking you this long. It shouldn't be that hard. You've just lost patience.
I glared at him.
That's right,
he said, as if he'd been waiting to say it for days.
I've almost worked out the next riddle, and you're still working on the last one. But I've been trying to stay out of this. We work at our own paces, and you don't even want my help, so fine, do it alone. Just don't try turning this back on me.
We didn't speak again that night. Had I listened, I might have learned my lesson earlier. Instead, I went out of my way to prove Paul wrong. I began working later and waking earlier, making a habit of rolling my alarm back 15 minutes each day, hoping he'd notice the steady imposition of discipline on the untended quarters of my life. Each day I found a new way to spend more time with Kelowna, and each night I tallied my hours like a miser counting coins. 8 on Monday, 9 on Tuesday, 10 on Wednesday and Thursday, almost 12 on Friday. What do a blind beetle, a night owl, and a twist-beaked eagle share? Horned beetles are hung around the necks of infants as a remedy against disease, Pliny wrote. Gold beetles make a poisonous honey and are unable to survive in a locality near Thrace called Cantharolethus. Black beetles congregate in dark corners and are found mostly in baths, but blind beetles? I found more time by not walking out to Cloister for meals. Every round trip to Prospect Avenue cost me half an hour, and eating in company rather than alone probably cost another half as well. I stopped working in the president's room at Ivy, both to avoid seeing Paul and to save the minutes I would otherwise have spent in transit. I kept phone calls to a minimum, shaved and showered only as necessary, let Charlie and Gil answer the door, and made a science of the economies I could produce by giving up the humble reliables of my life. What do a blind beetle, a night owl, and a twist-beaked eagle share? Of creatures that can fly and are bloodless, Aristotle wrote, some are coleopterous or sheath-winged, like the beetle. Of birds that fly by night, some have crooked talons, such as the night raven and owl, and in old age, the upper beak of the eagle grows gradually longer and more crooked, such that the bird slowly dies of starvation. But what do the three of them share? Katie, I'd decided, was a lost cause. Whatever she'd been to me, she became someone else for Donald Morgan. How I saw so much of them when I left my room so little must have had its answer in my thoughts and dreams, where they were constantly making fools of themselves. In corners and alleys, in shadows and clouds, there they were, holding hands and kissing and making sweet talk, all of it for my benefit, flaunting the way a shallow heart is quickly broken but just as quickly fixed. There was a black bra of Katie's that she'd left in my room long ago, which I'd never remembered to return, and it became a sort of trophy to me, a symbol of the part of herself she'd left behind, which Donald couldn't have. I had visions of her standing naked in my bedroom, souvenirs of the day we'd enjoyed our own company so much that she forgot herself around me, forgot that I was someone else and let her inhibitions go. Every detail of her shape stayed with me, every freckle on her back, every gradation of shadow beneath her breasts. She danced to the music that came over my alarm clock, running one hand through her hair, keeping one hand over the invisible microphone in front of her mouth, and I was the only audience. What do a blind beetle, a night owl, and a twist-beaked eagle share?
They all fly, but Pliny says that beetles sometimes burrow. They all breathe, but Aristotle says that insects don't inhale. They never learn from their mistakes, for Aristotle says that many animals have memory, but no other creature except man can recall the past at will. But even men fail to learn from the past. By that yardstick, we are all of us blind beetles and night owls. On Thursday, the 4th of March,
I reached the high water mark of my time with the Hypnerotomachia. That day I spent 14 hours rereading sections of 6 Renaissance natural historians and making 21 single-space pages of notes. I went to no classes, ate all 3 meals at my desk, and slept exactly 3.5 hours that night. I hadn't seen Frankenstein in weeks. The only other thoughts that had crossed my mind were of Katie, and those just compelled me to make an even greater shambles of my life. The sheer mastery of myself was addictive. Something must have been, because I'd made almost no progress on the riddle. "Shut the books," Charlie finally said that Friday night, taking a stand. He pulled me by the collar in front of a mirror.
"Look at yourself."
"I'm fine," I began, ignoring the lupine thing that stared back at me, all red eyes and pink nose and scruff. But Gil stood at Charlie's side.
"Tom, you look like hell."
He stepped into the bedroom, something he hadn't done in weeks.
"Listen, she wants to talk to you. Stop being so stubborn."
"I'm not being stubborn. I've just got other things to do."
Charlie grimaced.
"Like what? Paul's thesis?"
I scowled, waiting for Paul to stand up for me. But he just stood there behind them, silent. For more than a week, he'd hoped that an answer was just around the bend, that I was making progress against the riddle, just painful progress.
"We're going to the Arch Sing at Blair," Gil said, meaning the Friday a cappella concert held outdoors.
"All 4 of us," Charlie added.
Gil gently closed the book beside me.
"Katie's going to be there. I told her you'd come."
But when I flipped the book back open and said I wasn't going, I remember the look that crossed his face. It was one Gil had never given me before, one he'd always reserved for Parker Hassett and the occasional class clown who didn't know when to stop.
"You're coming," Charlie said, stepping toward me, but Gil waved him off.
"Forget it, let's just go." Then I was alone. It wasn't stubbornness or pride or even devotion to Kelowna that kept me away from Blair Arch. It was heartache, I think, and defeat. The fact is that I loved Katie, and also, in an odd way, that I loved the Hypnerotomachia, and that I'd failed to win either of them.
The look on Paul's face as he left meant he knew I'd lost my chance with the riddle, whether I knew it or not. And the look on Gil's face as he left meant he knew I'd done the same with Katie. Staring at a group of woodcuts in the Hypnerotomachia, the same ones Taft would use in his lecture a month later, the ones of Cupid driving women into a forest on a burning chariot, I thought of Karachi's engraving. Here I was, being pummeled by the little boy as my 2 loves looked on. This was what my father meant, the lesson he'd hoped I would learn. "Our hardships cannot move him. Love conquers all."
The 2 hardest things to contemplate in life, Richard Curry once told Paul, are failure and age, and those are one and the same. Perfection is the natural consequence of eternity. Wait long enough and anything will realize its potential. Coal becomes diamonds, sand becomes pearls, apes become men. It's simply not given to us in one lifetime to see those consummations, and so every failure becomes a reminder of death. But love lost is a special kind of failure, I think. It's a reminder that some consummations, no matter how devoutly wished for, never come. That some apes will never be men, not in all the world's ages. What's a monkey to think who, with a typewriter and eternity, still can't eke out Shakespeare? To hear Katie say that she wanted to make it final, that she and I were finished, would stunt all my sense of possibility. To watch her there beneath Blair Arch, warming herself in Donald Morgan's arms, would strip the pearls and diamonds from my future. And then it happened. Just as I'd reached the full bloom of self-pity, a knock came at the door. It was followed by a turning of the knob. And the same way it had happened 100 times before, Katie let herself in. Beneath her coat, I could see she was wearing my favorite of her sweaters, the emerald-colored one that matched her eyes.
"You're supposed to be at the Arch Sing," was the first thing I managed to say, and of all the monkey-written combinations, it was probably the worst.
"So are you," she said, staring me up and down. I knew how I must look to her. The wolf Charlie had shown me in the mirror was the one Katie saw now.
"Why are you here?" I said, glancing at the door.
"They're not coming." She forced herself back into my focus.
"I'm here so you can apologize."
For a second, I thought Gil had put her up to this, inventing something about how bad I felt, how I just didn't know what to say. But another glance told me otherwise. She knew I had no intention of saying I was sorry.
"Well?
You think this is my fault?" I asked.
"Everyone does."
"What everyone?"
"Do it, Tom. Apologize."
Arguing with her was only making me angrier with myself.
"Fine. I love you. I wish things had worked out. I'm sorry they didn't."
"If you wish things had worked out, why didn't you do anything?"
"Look at me," I told her. The four-day beard, the unkempt hair. "This is what I did."
"You did that for the book."
"It's the same thing."
"I'm the same as the book?"
"Yes."
She glared at me as if I'd dug myself a hole. But she knew what I was about to say. She'd just never accepted it.
"My father spent his life on the Hypnerotomachia," Machia, I told her. "I've never felt more excited than when I'm working on it. I lose sleep over it. I don't eat because of it. I have dreams about it." I found myself looking around, searching for words. "I don't know how else to say it. It's like going to the battlefield to see your tree. Being near it makes me feel like everything's right, like I'm not lost anymore."
I kept my eyes away from her.
"So are you the same as the book to me?"
"Yes,
of course you are. You're the only thing that's the same as the book to me."
I made a mistake. I thought I could have you both. I was wrong.
"Why am I here, Tom?"
"To rub it in."
"Why?"
"To make me apologize."
"Tom,"
she stopped me with a look.
"Why am I here?"
"Because you feel the same way I do."
"Yes."
"Because this was too important to leave it up to me."
"Yes."
"What do you want?" I said.
"I want you to stop working on the book."
"That's all?"
"That's all? That's all?"
Now, suddenly, emotion.
"I'm supposed to feel sorry for you because you gave up on us to act like a slob and live in that book? You ass. I spent 4 days with my shades down and my door locked. Karen called my parents. My mom flew down from New Hampshire." Shut up. It isn't your turn to talk. I went out to the battlefield to see my tree, and I couldn't. I couldn't because now it's our tree. I can't listen to music because every song is something we sang in the car or in my room or in here. It takes me an hour to get ready for class because I feel like I'm dazed half the time. I can't find my socks. I can't find my favorite black bra. Donald's always asking me, 'Honey, what's wrong? Honey, what's wrong?' 'Nothing's wrong, Donald.'"
She pushed her wrists into her cuffs and blotted her eyes.
"That's not what—" I began again,
but it still wasn't my turn.
"At least with Peter I could understand. We weren't perfect together. He loved lacrosse more than he loved me, I knew that. He wanted to get me in bed, and after that he lost interest."
She moved a hand through her hair, trying to push away the bangs that had gotten snarled in the tears.
"But you. I fought for you. I waited a month before I let you kiss me the first time. I cried the night after we slept together because I thought I was going to lose you."
She stopped, galled by the thought.
"And now I'm losing you to a book. A book. At least tell me it's not what I think, Tom. Tell me you've been seeing a senior on the side all this time.
Tell me it's because she doesn't do all the stupid things I do. She doesn't dance naked in front of you like some kind of idiot because she thinks you enjoy her singing. Or wake you up at 6 a.m. to go running because she wants to make sure every single morning that you're still there. Tell me something.
She looked up at me, broken in a way I know shamed her. And I could only think of one thing. There was a night, not long after the accident, when I accused my mother of not caring for my father. If you loved him, I said to her, you would have supported his work. The look that crossed her face, which I can't begin to describe, told me there was nothing more shameful in the world than what I had just said. I love you, I told Katie, stepping toward her so that she could press her face into my shirt and be invisible for a moment. I'm so sorry. And that was the moment, I think, when the tide began to change. My terminal condition, the love affair I thought was in my genes, slowly started to lose its grip on me. The triangle was collapsing. In its place stood a pair of points, a binary star separated by the smallest possible distance. A jumble of silences followed. All the things she needed to say but knew she shouldn't have to. All the things I wanted to say but didn't know how to. I'll tell Paul, I said, the best and most truthful thing I could. I'm going to stop working on the book. Redemption. The realization that I wasn't putting up a fight, that I'd finally figured out what was best for my own happiness, was enough to make Katie do something I think she was saving for much later, after I was back on the wagon for sure. She kissed me. And that moment of contact, like the lightning that gave the monster his second shot at life, created a new beginning. I didn't see Paul that night. I spent it with Katie, and ended up telling him my decision the next day at Dodd. He, too, seemed unsurprised. I'd been suffering so much with Kelowna that he sensed I might throw in the towel at the first sign of relief. He'd been persuaded by Gil and Charlie that it was the best thing anyway, and somehow he didn't hold it against me. Maybe he guessed I'd be back. Maybe he'd come far enough to think he could finish the riddles alone. Whatever it was, when I finally told him my reasoning, the lesson of Jenny Harlow and Karachi's engraving, he seemed to agree. I could tell from his expression that he knew more about Karachi than I did, but he never once corrected me. Paul, who had more reasons than anyone to believe that some interpretations are better than others, and that the right ones make all the difference, was generous about my spin on things, the same way he'd always been. It was more than his way of showing respect, I think. It was his way of showing friendship. It's better to love something that can love you back, he told me. It was the only thing he needed to say. What began as Paul's thesis then became Paul's thesis once more. At first, it looked as if he might pull it off alone. The fourth riddle, which had taken a whip to me, came to him in 3 days. I suspect he'd had the idea all along, but kept it from me because he knew I wouldn't take his advice. The answer was in a book called The Hieroglyphica, by a man named Horapollo, which turned up in Renaissance Italy in the 1420s, purporting to solve the ages-old problem of interpreting Egyptian hieroglyphics. Horapollo, taken by humanists to be some kind of ancient Egyptian sage, was in fact a 5th-century scholar who wrote in Greek and probably didn't know much more about hieroglyphics than Eskimos know about summer. Some of the symbols in his Hieroglyphica involve animals that aren't even Egyptian. Still, amidst the humanist fervor over new knowledge, the text became wildly popular, at least in the small circles where wild popularity and dead languages weren't mutually exclusive. The night owl, according to Horapollo, is a symbol of death. For the night owl suddenly descends upon the young of the crow in the night, as death comes upon a man suddenly. An eagle with a twisted beak, Horapollo wrote, signifies an old man dying of hunger, For when the eagle grows old, he twists his beak and dies of hunger. The blind beetle, finally, is a glyph that means a man has died from sunstroke, for a beetle dies when blinded by the sun. Cryptic as Horopalo's reasoning was, Paul knew immediately that he'd fixed on the right source, and he saw very quickly what the three animals had in common. Death. Applying the Latin word for it, mors, as his cipher, he produced Colonna's fourth message. You who have come so far are joined by the philosophers of my day, who in your time are perhaps the dust of ages, but who in mine were the giants of mankind. I am soon to put upon you the burden of what remains, for there is much to tell, and I grow fearful that my secret is too easily spread. But first, out of deference to your accomplishment, I will offer you the beginnings of my story, so that you will know I have not led you this far in vain. There is a preacher in the land of my brethren who has brought a great pestilence upon the lovers of knowledge. We have battled him with all our wit and influence, but this single man raises our countrymen against us. He thunders in the squares and from the pulpits, and the common men of all nations take up arms to do us harm. Just as God, out of jealousy, brought to nothing the tower in the plain of Shinar, which men built toward the heavens, so he raises his fist against us who attempt the very same. I did long ago hope that men wished to be delivered from ignorance, just as slaves wish to be freed from bondage. It is a condition unbecoming our dignity and contrary to our nature. Yet I find now that the race of men is a cowardly thing, a perversion like the owl of my riddle, which, though it might enjoy sunlight, prefers darkness. You will hear no more of me, reader, upon the completion of my crypt. To be a prince to such people as this is to be a castled kind of beggar. This book will be my only child. May it live long and serve you well. Paul hardly paused to contemplate it. He pushed on to the fifth and final riddle, which he'd found while I struggled with the fourth. Where do blood and spirit meet?
It's the oldest philosophical question in the book, he told me, while I puttered around the room preparing for a night with Katie.
What is?
The intersection of mind and body, the flesh-spirit duality. You see it in Augustine, in Contra Manichaeus. You see it in modern philosophy. Descartes thought he could pinpoint the soul somewhere near the pineal gland in the brain.
He continued that way, paging through a book from Firestone and sputtering philosophy while I packed. What are you reading? I asked, pulling my copy of Paradise Lost off the shelf to bring with me.
Galen, Paul said.
Who?
The second father of Western medicine after Hippocrates.
I remembered. Charlie had studied Galen in a history of science class. By Renaissance standards, though, Galen was no spring chick. He died 1,300 years before the Hypnerotomachia was published. Why? I asked.
I think the riddle is about anatomy. Francesco must have believed there was an actual organ in the body where blood and spirit met.
Charlie appeared in the doorway with the remains of an apple in his hand. What are you amateurs talking about? He said, hearing talk of things medical.
An organ like this, Paul said, ignoring him. The reti mirabili.
He pointed to a diagram in the book.
A network of nerves and vessels at the base of the brain. Galen thought this is where vital spirits turned into animal ones.
What's wrong with it? I asked, checking my watch.
I don't know. It doesn't work as a cipher.
That's because it doesn't exist in humans, Charlie said.
What do you mean?
Charlie looked up and took a last nibble from his apple.
Galen only dissected animals. The reti mirabili is something he found in an ox or a sheep.
Paul's expression faded.
He also made a meal of cardiac anatomy, Charlie continued. There's no septum?
Paul said, as if he knew what Charlie meant.
There is, there just aren't any pores in it.
What's a septum? I asked.
The wall of tissue between the two sides of the heart.
Charlie walked over to Paul's book and flipped through it to find a diagram of the circulatory system.
Galen got it all wrong. He said there were little holes in the septum where blood passed between the chambers.
There aren't?
No,
Paul snapped, beginning to sound as if he'd been working on this longer than I thought.
But Mondino made the same mistake about the septum. Versalius and Servetus figured it out, but not until the mid-1500s. Leonardo followed Galen. Harvey didn't describe the circulatory system until the 1600s. This riddle is from the late 1400s, Charlie. It has to be the Riti Mirabili or the septum. No one knew that air mixed with blood in the lungs.
Charlie chuckled.
No one in the West. The Arabs figured it out 200 years before your guy wrote his book.
Paul began rifling through his papers. Thinking the matter was settled, I turned to go.
I gotta run. I'll see you guys later.
But just as I moved toward the hallway, Paul found what he'd been looking for. The Latin he'd translated weeks earlier, the text of Colonna's third message.
The Arab doctor, he said. Was his name Ibn al-Nafiz?
Charlie nodded.
That's the one.
Paul was all excitement.
Francesco must have gotten the text from Andrea Alpago.
Who?
The man he mentions in the message, disciple of the venerable Ibn al-Nafiz.
Before either of us could speak, Paul was talking to himself.
What's Latin for lung? Pulmo?
I made for the door.
You're not going to wait to see what it says?
He asked, looking up. I'm supposed to be at Katie's in 10 minutes.
This'll only take 15, maybe 30.
I think it occurred to him only at that moment how much things had changed. I'll see you guys in the morning, I said. Charlie, who understood, smiled and wished me luck. It was a signal night for Paul, I think. He realized he'd lost me for good. He also sensed that no matter what Colonna's final message was, it couldn't possibly contain the man's entire secret when so little had been revealed in the first four parts. The second half of the Hypnerata Machia, which we had always assumed was filler, must in reality contain more ciphered text. And whatever consolation Paul took in Charlie's medical knowledge or in having solved the fifth riddle, it dissipated quickly when he saw Colonna's message and realized that he was right. I fear for you, reader, as I fear for myself. As you have perceived, it was my intention at the beginning of this text to betray to you my meanings, no matter how deeply I wrapped them in codes. I have wished for you to find what you seek, and have acted as your guide. Now, however, I find that I have not faith enough in my own creation to continue in this manner. Perhaps I cannot judge the true difficulty of the riddles here contained, even if their creators assure me none but a true philosopher could solve them. Perhaps these wise men, too, are jealous of my secret, and have misled me so that they may steal what is rightfully ours. He is clever indeed, this preacher, with followers in every camp. I fear he turns my soldiers against me. It is as a defense to you, then, reader, that I pursue my present course. Where you have become accustomed to finding a riddle within my chapters, you will henceforth find no riddles at all, and no solutions to lead you. I will employ only my rule of four for the duration of Polyphilo's journey, but I will offer you no suggestion of its nature. Only your intellect will guide you now. May God and genius, friend, shepherd you aright. It was confidence alone, I think, that prevented Paul from sensing his abandonment until many days had passed. I had left him. Colonna had left him. Now he navigated alone. He tried at first to re-involve me in the process. We had solved so much together that he thought it would be selfish to let me absent myself in the 11th hour. We were so close, he thought. We had so little left to do. Then a week passed, and another. I was beginning again with Katie, relearning her,
loving her alone. So much had happened in the weeks we'd been apart that I was more than occupied trying to catch up. We alternated meals at Cloister and at Ivy. She had new friends. We had new routines. There were family matters of hers I began to take an interest in. I sensed that once I'd won her trust back completely, she had things she wanted to tell me. Everything Paul had learned about Kelowna's riddles, meanwhile, began to fail him. Like a body of work slowly decaying in function, the Hypnerata Machia resisted all his trusted medicines. The rule of four was elusive. Kelowna had given no indication of its origin. Charlie, the hero of the fifth riddle, stayed up with Paul some nights, worrying about the effect my departure was having. He never asked me to help, knowing what the book had done to me once, but I saw the way he hovered over Paul, like a doctor eyeing a patient he fears is trending badly. A darkness was setting in, a book lover's heartbreak, and Paul was helpless against it. He would suffer without my help until Easter weekend. Chapter 19. On the way back to Dodd, I shuffle through Katie's pictures of Princeton Battlefield. In shot after shot, I've caught her in mid-motion, running toward me, hair streaking behind, mouth half open, her words caught somewhere in the registers of experience beyond the camera's range. The pleasure of imagining her voice in them is the joy of these pictures. In another 12 hours, I'll see her at Ivy, escorting her to the ball she's been anticipating almost since we met, and I know what she'll be waiting for me to say. That I've made a choice I can stick to, that I've learned, that I won't be returning to the Hypnerata Machia. When I get back to the room, I expect to find Paul at his desk, but his bunk is still empty, and now the books on his dresser are gone. Taped to the top of the doorframe is a note, this one in large red letters. "Tom, where are you? Came back looking for you. Figured out 4S10E2N6W. Gone to pick up Topo Atlas at Firestone. Then went down to Makosh. Vincent says he has the blueprint. 10:15 p. I read the message again, piecing it together. The basement of Makosh Hall is the location of Taft's office on campus. But the last line leaves me cold. Vincent says he has the blueprint. I pick up the phone and call the squad house. Charlie's on the line in a matter of seconds. What's up, Tom? Paul went to see Taft. What? I thought he was going to talk to the dean about Stein. We need to find him. Can you get someone to cover for you? Before I can even finish, a muffled sound interrupts the call, and I hear Charlie talking to someone on the other end. When did Paul leave? He says, returning to the line. 10 minutes ago. I'm on my way. We'll catch up to him. Charlie's 1973 Volkswagen Karmann Ghia pulls up in back of Dodd more than 15 minutes later. The old car looks like a metal toad rusted in mid-hop. Before I've even lowered myself into the passenger seat, Charlie's got it in reverse. What took you so long? I ask. A reporter showed up at the squad room when I was leaving, he said. She wanted to talk to me about last night. So? Someone at the police department told her what Taft said in his interrogation. We pull onto Elm Drive, where little crests of slush give the asphalt a choppy surface, like ocean water at night. Didn't you tell me Taft knew Richard Curry a long time ago? Yeah, why? Because he told the cops he only knew Curry through Paul. Just as we enter North Campus, I spot Paul in the courtyard between the library and the history department, walking toward Makosh. Paul! I call out the window. What are you doing? Charlie snaps at him, pulling up to the curb. I solved it, Paul says, surprised to see us. The whole thing! I just need the blueprint, Tom. You're not going to believe this. It's the most amazing... What? Tell me. But Charlie isn't hearing any of it. You're not going to Taft's, he says. You don't understand. It's done. Charlie leans on the car horn, filling the courtyard with noise. Listen to me, Charlie interrupts. Paul, get in the car. We're going home. He's right, I say. You shouldn't have come out here alone.
I'm going to Vincent's, Paul says quietly, and begins walking in the direction of Taft's office. I know what I'm doing.
Charlie forces the car into reverse, keeping up with Paul.
You think he's just going to give you what you want?
He called me, Charlie. That's what he said he was going to do.
He admitted he stole it from Curry, I ask. Why would he give you the blueprint now?
Paul, Charlie says, stopping the car, he's not given you anything.
The way he says it, Paul stops. Charlie lowers his voice and explains what he learned from the reporter.
When the police asked Taft last night if he could think of anyone who might have done something like this to Stein, Taft said he could think of two people.
The expression on Paul's face starts to fade, the excitement of his discovery waning.
The first was Curry, Charlie says. The second was you.
He pauses, letting the emphasis stand.
So I don't care what the man told you over the phone, you need to stay away from him.
An old white pickup truck rumbles down the road past us, snow crunching beneath its tires.
Then help me, Paul says.
We will. Charlie opens the door. We'll drive you home. Paul tightens his coat around him.
Help me by coming with me. After I get the blueprint from Vincent, I don't need him anymore.
Charlie stares.
Are you even hearing us?
But there are sides to this that Charlie doesn't understand. He doesn't know what it means that Taft has been hiding the blueprint all along.
I'm this close to having it in my hands, Charlie, Paul says. All I have to do is stand up for what I've found, and you're telling me to go home?
Look, Charlie begins, I'm just saying we need to... But I interrupt. Paul, we'll come with you.
What?
Charlie says. Come on. I open the passenger door. Paul turns, not expecting this.
If he's going with or without us, I say to Charlie under my breath, leaning back into the car, then I'm going too.
Paul begins walking toward McCosh as Charlie considers his position.
Taft can't do anything if there are three of us, I say. You know that.
Charlie exhales slowly, sending a cloud of steam into the air. Finally, he makes a space for the car in the snow and pulls the keys from the ignition. The walk to Taft's office takes an eternity, pacing up to the gray edifice in the snow. The room lies in the bowels of McCosh, where the hallways are so cramped and the stairs are so steep we have to descend single file. It's hard to believe Vincent Taft can breathe in here, let alone move. Even I get the sensation of being too big for the place. Charlie must feel like he's trapped. I look back just to make sure he's still there. The sight of him behind us, filling the doorways and covering our backs, gives me enough confidence to keep moving. I realize now what I was too bluff to admit before. If Charlie hadn't come with us, I couldn't have gone through with this. Paul leads us down a final hallway, toward the single room at the end. Because of the weekend and the holiday, every other office is locked up and dark. Only beneath the white door bearing the placard of Taft's name do I see the rich glow of light. The paint on the door is chipped, curling over itself near the edge where it closes into the jamb. On the bottom of the panel is a faint line of discoloration, the high water mark of an old flood from the steam tunnels coiled just beneath the basement floor, a stain unpainted since Taft's arrival in the time before time. Paul raises his hand to knock when a voice comes from inside.
You're late, Taft growls.
The knob squeaks when Paul turns it. I feel Charlie bump up against my back.
Go on, he whispers, pushing me forward.
Taft is sitting alone behind a great antique desk, sunken into a leather chair.